Hello, my name is Rianne Ten Veen. I'm originally from the Netherlands and currently live just outside Birmingham in England in the UK.
And you are here for what reason today at the Open University?
I am starting my PhD around globalization and surveillance, and it feels a bit like a first day at big school almost.
You did look so excited walking in. Have you had a chance to talk to many of the other people here?
Yes, I have had a chance to speak with several people, and it's really interesting the variety of backgrounds that we come from, and also the start of a new chapter in my life, the opportunity to really delve in a bit deeper into a topic that I've been touching upon for a while, but more, you know, outside work time, so to speak, in my spare time, and now the opportunity to really focus on it properly.
Tell me more about your research. What are you specializing in?
It'll be focusing on globalization and surveillance, but obviously that's way too big and broad to capture in 3 years. So I'm looking at narrowing it down around some ethical issues around new technologies in humanitarian aid. Most likely case studies will be around drones and iris scans and the impact that has.
Looks like the food and drinks are being ferried into the big meeting hall. Tell me more about your experience around research with drones in particular.
Well, it was actually because my background is, I do have several academic degrees, but actually my practical work was more in disaster management, particularly focusing on complex emergency, which is a fancy word for saying man-made mess, and really seeing some of those issues that are we not as humanitarians, as humanitarian community, not enabling the continuation of the need for humanitarian response by almost mopping with the tap open? Shouldn't we actually focusing on closing the tap, which is causing all of these refugees and disaster response needs?
And interesting, with the world of high-spec technology, particularly around drones at the moment, I see so much news about drones being used for good, especially in the hands of citizen reporters, documenting from above, medicines being delivered across danger zones. How does this popularize drones in the eyes of the civilian world when I've also spoken to the other side, people who have suffered greatly at the hands of weaponry attached to this technology?
Yeah, well, fantastic question. And it's not going to be drones are bad, or I'm going to conclude you've got armed drones which are bad and you've got humanitarian drones which are good. It's probably going to be somewhere in the middle, which is why I'm going to need 3 years to look at it properly. But it's the idea of when and why and how are they going to be able to be used? Are people affected by drones? Are they going to be able to distinguish between the different types of drones by, for example, having them in different colors or flying at different heights, so that, you know, it might not necessarily be an issue of normalizing drones, because then obviously you could have issues around situation having more access to military drones, when actually as humanitarians we want to stay away from any of the conflict parties. We want to focus on humanitarian response, but we need to also reflect and be honest as to our role, whether we might be contributing to making the environment more complex for those caught up in disasters.
And I guess there's some other interesting takes on this, on when we are using robots to deliver aid, where is the human contact?
Yes, that's,
I guess that's a paper all by itself.
That's a whole different paper by itself. I'm not looking at robots, but I am.
Well, a drone in some ways.
Oh, yeah, drones in some ways. And it's also who's got the access to that. I mean, the other case study which you might be thinking of is the iris scan situation that I'm looking at. And that, in the sense of, you know, there's a lot of good intention that we only want people who properly qualify as disaster affected to get our aid and you know, have our humanitarian aid be spent most effective and efficiently.
So you're saying that so that we know where our aid money is going, we are cataloguing which we've catalogued human beings in camps way, way back through history, and where it used to be a serial number on an arm, now it's a retinal scanner, as I saw for myself in Calais. People will be given RFID chips, so which for me seems a lot looser. I like the use of that technology. Here is the chip here for your family, so your family can come and collect food, and we know your family has got its quota of food. With a retinal scan, that must not only is that sounding very invasive, but how flexible is that?
Well, the full answer come back to me in 3 years, because that is what I'm going to be focusing. But you bring precisely up some of the huge issues at stake, that they used to have ATM cards. But obviously, if you're fleeing, you're going to check whether you've got your kids with you. You're not going to give a first priority whether you've got your ATM card with you. So the intention is again suggested as being fairly positive, as being you're not going to leave your retina behind, you'll always have it with you. But you rightly also then mentioned some of the challenges with that. What if the head of household is registered, but the head of household is unwell? They can't send any of their family to pick up the food because obviously they're not registered. Or if they are registered, and who's again got access to that database, and how might we as humanitarian community make the disaster affected people feel if they've just fled? You know, you don't just flee for nothing, you flee because you're fearing for your life. If you're then asked to give a retinal picture as a means to be eligible or have access to aid, how is that maybe affecting your post-traumatic stress and your fear of being found out? Because obviously not everyone, especially the regime you might be fleeing from, will think it's a very good idea of you leaving the country.
Wow. Sounds like you've got an amazing and fascinating few years ahead of you. You just mentioned for a second, if I might touch upon this, the post-traumatic stress and how if we flip things totally over, a lot of sometimes drones are being done to distance the soldiers that are being told to kill from the actual killing. And yet studies are showing that the distance isn't far enough still, and they are suffering through, even though there is a layer of game mechanics on the pulling of the trigger and the destruction that ensues afterwards. Human beings are affected by this.
Yeah, well, I'm looking more from the humanitarian side of things, not what the military motivations might be, but obviously how they might affect if, as a humanitarian community, calling for too much use of drones or iris scan for completely legitimate reasons, might that not actually then be abused in some other way? Because who's got access to the database? You know, who's funding your humanitarian aid program? Does that then not go back to players who maybe indirectly shouldn't have access to such databases?
And data leaks being as prevalent as they are at the moment, losing a database of biometric data of desperate people, very disturbing prospect.
And another aspect is also about, if we're saying we're allocating so many million to respond to the humanitarian disaster, people might assume that that is the amount that actually goes to the field and gets spent on food packets or tents or what have you. But actually, if a significant amount of that fund is actually staying in the West to develop all of these technologies, to what extent is that actually contributing to North-South power divide? And to what extent is the humanitarian community actually enabling and facilitating this continuation or furtherance of this power divide?
Wow. You've spent quite a lot of time on the ground working with different organizations. Could you name three aid agencies or organizations that you personally have had contact with and have huge respect for the work they're doing? Because sometimes we get quite, I mean, I find it very difficult. Do I assist and help Médecins Sans Frontières that I've seen firsthand and I'm just blown away sometimes at what it is they do? But sometimes we're awash with asks for assistance, and I don't know, maybe you can't recommend anybody that we should look into.
Well, I could, but I'd prefer not to, and I'll tell you why. Is one, there's agencies working in lots of different countries, and some agencies might be more successful in one setting than in another setting for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
So obviously, if you have a maybe particular preference to help African setting, then certain agencies might be better because they've got more capacity on the ground, not because they have any worse intentions. If it's certain Asian countries, other agencies might be better. What I would suggest is, if when looking at where do you give your money to, is don't just look at simplistic things like overhead. People think, overhead is bad because it means it doesn't get to the end beneficiary. The thing is, overhead means getting staff to do the job to some extent. I mean,
Tools and the infrastructure to make the stuff funnel there quicker.
And invest in lesson learned. I mean, would you want to go to a restaurant and pay just for the ingredients on your plate? No, there's a chef who needs to cook it. There's a restaurant that needs to be put out. There's taxes that need to be paid. All kinds of like behind the scenes boring stuff, but which enable the restaurant to run. I mean, it's a bit of a silly example.
No, I get it.
But I'm using it because it's something that people can relate to more. So in that sense, similarly with responding to the field, there's a lot of logistics behind the scenes which could be avoided, but then you're having to wing it. And is winging it a suitable approach? I've seen, which I might be able to mention then as a case, where you had a smallish NGO which prided itself in saying no overhead. The thing is, the way they were managing to able to do that is by having a cousin back home who did it in the weekend. So that person, you're not then having an honest situation. So the person doing it has a full-time job, does the voluntary thing in the weekend, but doesn't investigate who is the most in need. They just go to the ones who are most accessible. And if, as a humanitarian aid agency, you want to really have a principled approach and say, we're going for the bottom of the pile, the worst affected, you need time and resources to find those, because they're not going to come to your queue. They're going to be housebound. They're going to have disabilities. They're going to be traumatized. You need to go and invest time in finding them. And that is then on the balance sheet listed as overhead. But, you know, take a bit of a more holistic picture in that sense. Hope that still answers a little bit.
Yeah, very much so. I'm really looking forward. So 3 years sounds like a long time to wait for your research for me to read. Will you be documenting and sharing your research as you go along, maybe through the graduate network?
Yes, of course. I mean, I really like that the Open University has set up the graduate network where we can indeed share all of our things. The challenge, I think, with my topic will be is if I share certain aspects and I might highlight that there are power dynamics that certain stakeholders might not wish to have light shone on, is I might be doing myself or making life difficult for myself if I shine
You're
the light.
You're that troublemaker.
Yes.
I'm sure you've been there before, in the world that you live in.
So I'll probably share some anecdotes maybe along the road as to, you know, what motivated me, some anecdotes of field visits I've done and why I think it's such a crucial and important issue, although, you know, I'm not saying just my PhD is going to save the world or anything. It's going to be a tiny, tiny contribution.
It shines a light. Yeah.
That's my hope. So I'm hoping to share what I can, but I think particularly considering my topic, I may need to be cautious as to what I share when, because I do need certain doors to remain open long enough for me to be able to get the information that I actually need to make a properly researched research report, because indeed, obviously, some of the topics can also be quite emotional and sensitive, and people might say, oh, you know, but whatever it takes to stop the baddies, or, you know, anything's feasible and allowed when it concerns saving people from famine. But actually, obviously, at PhD, it's a little bit more about grey shades and looking at it from all the different angles and saying, I appreciate that this is one view, but you can't make
Sweeping generalizations
based on just gut feelings. Yeah. So it'll be really relevant for me to look at all those different angles. And some angles may wish to get their voice heard more than others.
Yeah. Well, I really hope you get to share some of that analytical process so we can have a light shone within those grey areas and enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you.